God Love and Another versus Rothstein, Norman A. Thomas, Andrew P. Hill, Appellant's Counsel, Robert J. Light, Joseph P. Silek, Appellee's Counsel. Chief Justice, it appears that both parties are present and ready to begin.
All right, you may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Goodwin. My name is Norman Thomas, and along with Mr. Andrew P. Hill, I represent Teresa Wolf and Robert Godlove in this appeal. The appeal arises from a dispute between Godlove and Wolf on the one hand and Mr. Daniel Rothstein on the other hand, regarding property rights defined in the Clary Farm subdivision deed of dedication. Their dispute focuses on an ingress and egress easement, of which Godlove and Wolf's lot 13 is the servient tract, and Mr. Rothstein's lot 14 has been the dominant tract. I'd like to turn first to the motion to dismiss appeal and cross appeal and for vacator of the trial court judgment that Mr. Rothstein recently has filed. Since the filing of the motion and our response, and Mr. Chief Justice, if I may pause briefly here, I would like to reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Yes, sir. Since the filing of the motion and our response, Mr. Rothstein has filed with the clerk of this court a deed, I believe it's dated December 10th, where he has sold his lot 14 to Mr. and Mrs. Brown. Our position is that once that deed was filed, then Mr. Rothstein has established a predicate, a factual and legal predicate for his motion. And we are satisfied that the Fairfax County versus Ratliff decision will be applicable to this case. And there's 2 points and 2 effective requests that Godlove and Wolf would make of this court. First, in our response, we have asked that there be a taxing of costs in the case. We submit that the taxing of costs as a result of a dismissal of the appeal and the entry of an order of vacator of the trial court judgment is appropriate, not only under the equity cases we've cited, but also Rule 5:35, which provides that when there is when a judgment is vacated, the court may order a taxation of costs, and as well under Code Section 17.1-605, which of course is applicable and imposes some limitations on the amounts for briefing that can be awarded. The other point is this. Ratliff is a relatively new decision. There's no other decisions by this court that flesh out all the particulars of it. And what Godlove and Wolf are asking the court to do is either, one, expressly state in an order of vacator that all questions of collateral estoppel are eliminated, and there is precedent for that, or in the alternative, simply utilize the language that the order of vacator is with prejudice. These parties have been in litigation.
Mr. Thomas, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this question? I understand your first point about not wanting claim or issue preclusion, but isn't that Hornbook law that the vacature of an order, no matter how elaborate the order might be factually or legally, the vacature eliminates all issues of collateral estoppel and res judicata? Why would we need to say what I think is Hornbook law unless I've misread it?
Your Honor, I do not believe that you have misread it. The situation is this. 3 weeks before oral argument, my clients have learned that their appeal likely will be dismissed and that vacator will be entered. I would cite a case to the court that also addressed these types of client concerns. We understand vacator and mootness in a way as professionals in the legal system that laypersons do not. I cited in our response the Minnesota case that has cited Ratliff, and within the Minnesota case, there are a number of other multi-state citations. One of them is to Massachusetts Court of Appeals in the Agricultural Research Corporation. It's at 41 Northeast 3rd, 318. And in that case, the court recognized that the parties who had been at issue for a long time still had residual concerns about issues of collateral estoppel. And the Massachusetts Court of Appeals directly cited U.S. versus Munsingware, where it discusses that the judgment is eliminated through vacator and that the rights of the parties are preserved and not prejudiced, and then made it express that that eliminates all questions of collateral estoppel between the parties. And we see it, Your Honor, in simplicity terms, that it is an accommodation to laypersons who have a difficult time understanding this, and also in light of the fact that Ratliff is a decision that is not yet 2 years old by this court, and there's no other citations of it or discussions of it by the court. And we
ask. Okay, so can I segue to your second condition that you're advocating, which is, and I think I might be misunderstanding Ms. Thomas, but tell me if I am. I think the second argument you're making is you want the order, the vacature order, to actually rule in your favor on the merits, not just vacate the other guy's win, but to rule in your favor so that the successors in interest to the property are stuck with it. Isn't that the opposite of your first point?
Your Honor, as we have moved toward oral argument, I have tried to do the research that's necessary to address my client's concerns and not run afoul of exactly what the court has raised. We're not seeking to win the case. We understand that vacator wipes the slate clean as if the lawsuit had never been brought. And we're not seeking anything beyond that. And that's why in doing the additional research and finding the Massachusetts case, which allayed the same concerns by saying there is no possible collateral estoppel between the parties, will take care of the issue that has been of such great concern and so recent an advent to my clients. I will touch briefly upon the merits of the case in that this is the last opportunity to address the court. We do submit that the trial court erroneously interpreted dedication section 19 with respect to this easement. If the court looks at the language of dedication section 19, it's on page 177 of the appendix, you'll see that the drafters of the deed of dedication went from the general to specific when it discusses ingress and egress issues. It said that beneficiaries of the ingress and egress issues are responsible for the maintenance. And then when it talks about roads in the very next sentence, it gets more specific. It states that with respect to roads, the cost of maintaining shall be split equally between the two lots served. It's conceded by Mr. Rothstein that the two lots served here are 13 and 14. And then it stays with that same specificity and says that any major improvements shall be agreed upon in writing by the two lot owners, which the lot owners of the two lots served, obviously here is God, Love, and Wolf in the case of lot 13 and lot 14 being Mr. Rothstein. What the trial court's judgment did was allow carve out an exception, which is not in the language and not in the context of reformation of the deed of dedication, to say that Mr. Rothstein could build any kind of major improvement on the servient tract that he chose at any time, as long as he didn't seek financial contributions for future maintenance.
Mr. Thomas, may I ask you, without disclosing confidential conversations between you and Mr. Light, have the two of you had an opportunity to discuss the taxable cost issue and the dispute between you and how a possible compromise of that would be reasonable? Or is that a subject you've not had a chance, given how fast these events have occurred, to address among yourselves?
It is more the latter situation. Mr. Light and I have not negotiated on that matter. I know that Mr. Light opposes a taxation of costs.
Mr. Ross, that's enough. Thank you so much.
All right. I'm going to reserve the remainder of my times, but also say that we rely, of course, on our brief with respect to the motion to dismiss the cross error and the merits of that matter.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. You have 5 minutes and 29 seconds remaining. Mr. Light.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Robert Light, and I am counsel for the appellee cross appellant Daniel Rothstein in this case. I will begin with discussing the our motion to dismiss the appeal, cross appeal, and for vacator. It's fairly straightforward. On December 10th of last year, the closing on the sale of Mr. Rothstein's property in the Clary Farm subdivision was completed. And because that property was the subject of the present appeal and cross appeal, the sale renders the appellate litigation moot, which appears to be a point on which the parties can agree.
And Mr. Light, this is Justice Kelsey. Mr. Thomas has suggested that since there's an agreement on mootness and there's an agreement on a vacature order, he would like the language of the order to express the definition of vacature, which is it's without prejudice to either side going forward on all issues, because the order is obviously vacated. Do you object to his request?
On the first one, no. As you said, that is simply stating the black letter law that it's as if the litigation of Rothstein 2, as we've been distinguishing between Rothstein 1 and Rothstein 2, never happened. And so a black letter law explanation, I don't think would be offensive to anyone on that point.
And on the second point, he wants at least at minimum a sharing of taxable costs. Your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. And let me get to that demand. He's in looking at his response or looking at the appellant's response. They cite the fact that Mr. Rothstein had marketed the property for months. In our view, that observation has no probative value, because marketing a property, even signing a contract, does not render the appeal and cross appeal moot. It was still a live case until the day that Mr. Rothstein conveyed all of his interest in the property.
But the Mr. Light, this mootness case is a little different from the norm, because mootness in this case is triggered by the action of the successful litigant below, your client.
Correct.
Mootness is typically a third party action on the parties. And in this situation, we use the normal default taxation of cost rules, but the fact that you dropped the mic and walked off even after you won the case on appeal, is that not an equitable consideration that the court could use to require the parties to at minimum share taxable costs? I don't even know how much we're talking about, but can't be but so much.
Well, I think it's, I think if I recall, it was it's around slightly under $3,000, I think was the claim. But no, because when you look at Ratcliffe, it is the vacator itself, which is the equitable relief. As this court observed in that case, the equitable remedy of vacator ensures that those who have been prevented from obtaining the review to which they are entitled are not treated as if there had been a review. And that was quoting United States Supreme Court precedent. So their citation to equity must do equity in the Hynob case, number one, is distinguishable on its facts, because those facts are relatively unique. They dealt with the fact that a litigant, that the appellee had come to the trial court seeking basically access to water from Hynob system, and the trial court, who was affirmed on by this court, allowed for that, but also said, you've got to do equity, so therefore you've got to pay something for it. So so basically the equitable relief that they would be entitled to is the vacator itself. As far as fair, and also, Your Honor, the other concern my client has is that if you establish a rule that says, I mean, first of all, selling one's property is not sanctionable or illegal in any way. And while my client would have no doubt been thrilled to have sold it earlier in the summer so that he could have, so that this case would have moved on earlier, The fact remains is he was not able to sell until December. The briefs and so forth and the appendix were due in September. So there's nothing that my client could have done and it to have prevented this set of facts. I mean, it's just, it is what it is. I would also note, Your Honor, that Mr. Rothstein also actively participated in this litigation until the very end. We filed our briefs. We have prepared as if, oral argument as if we would have had this not occurred. So no, I don't think equity in here would go for splitting the taxing of the costs, especially where, as here, Mr. Rothstein did everything, he didn't do anything wrong. He didn't, in this context, under these facts, I don't think the court wants to have a argument that standing alone, if you sell your property during pending litigation, you're going to be taxed cost automatically.
Okay.
So with that in mind, I think we've went through the concerns regarding the motion to dismiss. But for argument's sake, if for some reason the court were to consider the merits of the case, a few points I'd want to make. First, in turning to their appeal, their assignment of the appellant's assignment of error is based on the proposition that Section 19 of the Declaration requires each dominant and serviate tract owner to abide by 19, and that the consent of both the dominant and serviate estate holders are a prerequisite to any major improvements. The first point we raised in our brief was that reading is impossible if one considers the entirety of Section 19 of the Declaration. Section, for example, 19A, B, and C are where the Declaration grants a series of 40-foot wide private access easements, not just for my clients in the subdivision, but also in the, I think it's lots 10 and 11 and 8 and 9 were also granted similar easements across other lots. And of course, my clients, the parties are entitled to an easement across lots 13 and 15. But if you turn to the unnumbered provision of Section 19, which again is applicable to all of the easements granted, the third sentence of that unnumbered provision states that the costs of maintaining the easement are to be equally split between the two lots served, not necessarily split between all the dominant and servient estates. To put it simply, the language of Section 19 does not grant rights or responsibilities to the servient estate holder as a servient estate holder. The interests of section found in Section 19 are limited to co-easement. I'm sorry, someone asked a question.
No, just okay. Clearing my throat.
Oh, okay. And that basically what Section 13 does is it puts on the easement, the beneficiaries of the easement, the co-easement holders, the responsibility for maintenance of the easement area and keeping it in certain condition. So therefore, it is not the appellant's status as a servient estate which are implicated by Section 19. Rather, it is merely their status as a co-easement holder. And again, as the parties have acknowledged, the sentence regarding the written consent requirement is directly linked to the co-easement holder's obligations to pay for maintenance costs. We believe that the misreading by the appellant not only undermines their position substantively, but also cast adversely impacts their standing to bring this appeal. Case law and statute indicate that an appellant only has a standing to bring an appeal to the extent that their pecuniary or property interests are affected. Again, they're, in this case, the appellant's pecuniary and property interests are unrelated to their status as a servant of the state. Rather, it's their interests as a co-easement holder and their obligations to share in the maintenance costs. The trial court here expressly ruled that because the appellants objected to Mr. Rothstein's proposed expansion of the pavement within the easement area, they would have no financial obligations in the construction or future maintenance of those proposed expansions. Therefore, the appellant's relevant property and pecuniary interests have not been adversely impacted. They are not aggrieved parties and therefore lack standing under the statute to maintain the appeal. We also believe that their position is contrary to the case law regarding express easements. Citing the decision in Lynchburg v. Smith, an easement holder has the right to use all the right powers and privileges covered by the grant, which includes things which are expressly permitted or incidentally allowed by implication.
In fact, Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. Your briefing and Mr. Thomas's briefing is very well done. And do you have any further remarks on the mootness issue?
No, I do not, Your Honor. And with that, then I will, in light of the mootness issue, I don't think any further comment needs to be made. So I'm finished. Thank you.
All right. Any rebuttal, Mr. Thomas?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. The analysis on the cases regarding mootness and issuance of an order of vacator look at acts by the appellee, that is the prevailing party below, be they intentional. It looks at acts that are purely happenstance that are brought about by neither party. And then, of course, it looks at acts by the appellant themselves, the unsuccessful party at trial. We have recognized in our response that Mr. Rothstein's intentional act of selling his property is what's brought about this issue of mootness, and also the vacator order is that which he himself is requesting. There's no fault in selling your house, but there are consequences to this litigation for doing it. The request for a taxation of costs is perfectly in line with Rule 5:35's express terms, and also is greatly supported by the equitable cases that we cited in our response, that he who requests equity should do equity. And therefore, we reiterate that those supporting measures for a taxation of costs. I will speak very briefly to the merits of the appeal. The problem with Mr. Rothstein's argument with respect to the easement and dominant versus servient tract holders is that he detaches from the language of Dedication Section 19 in order to make it. We're dealing with a proposed improvement, a major improvement to a road, and the dedication is very clear. When that happens, it's to be agreed upon. The two lots served by the road are the two affected lots here, 13 and 14, and the two lot owners are the parties at litigation before the court. Section 19 grants the easement, governs the easement, and limits the easement. And Mr. Rothstein's position is such that he wishes to enjoy the grant of the easement, but he wishes not to submit to its governance, and in particular, to its limitations. And Justice Kelsey, you mentioned the briefing. In our reply brief, we stated a number of grounds on which Godlove and Wolf's property rights are affected by a major improvement other than future maintenance costs. And we literally gave a list of those types of considerations, whether it's ineffective to accomplish its intended purpose. It could be too large, it could be ugly, it could cause erosion, any number of things. And the free use of property by Godlove and Wolf is reserved to them by this deed of dedication, which governs the easement itself. We'll stand on those arguments, and unless the court has questions of me on behalf of God Loving Wolf, we simply ask that if the matter is dismissed now and vacator is ordered, that there be an express explanation that collateral estoppel consequences are wholly eliminated, as was done by the Massachusetts Court of Appeals and done in part by the Munsingware case. And if the court reaches the merits, that it reverse the trial court and also dismiss the cross error.
Mr. Thomas, may I ask you a question about the cross assignment of error?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're talking about vacating Rothstein 2. Rothstein 1 is still out there. What is your position as to what the trial court's ruling in Rothstein 1 is? Is it the original order, or is it the order as the trial court amended it some significant time later?
Well, inferring, Your Honor, that it is a final order, and we don't forget our position that we believe it cannot be determined from this record whether Rothstein 1 was even a final order. But going to the merits, the trial court here was very careful in its letter opinions in August of 2019 and January of 2020 to lay out what was not decided in Rothstein 1 based on the face of that order and the attached letter opinion from July of 2018 that was incorporated in Rothstein 1. It said that it was not reforming the deed of dedication, except as to one tiny Scrivener's error, that the major improvement provision of dedication section 19 was not involved in Rothstein 1. The right to add to the length of the roadway was not involved in Rothstein 1. And the use of the roadway for a turnaround area, as opposed to ingress and egress, was not before the court in Rothstein 1. Justice Powell, the only possible error here could be that when the trial court said it has to be limited to this geographic area where the rebar and the shrubbery and the rocks were, perhaps the court went a bit too far there. We do not concede that. But if it did, that modification was purely harmless error here.
Excuse me, Mr. Thomas, has he answered your question, Justice Powell?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Thank you both. We'll be in touch with you soon. Please call the next case.